She's a best-selling, award-winning Australian author of 13 books so far. They call her Miss Quiplash for her sharp, punning, witty observations. Her work's been made into TV series and movies. She's developed an underwater book and been writer-in-residence at the Savoy. She once turned down a date with George Clooney, and she's now married to a prominent human rights lawyer. Her latest work is a comedic novel which is set in the legal world. Kathy Lett, welcome to Meet the Writers, or rather, thank you for welcoming me as we're recording this interview at your home in London. Now, I'd like to take you all the way back to your first book, Puberty Blues, published in 1979 when you were still a teenager.
Well, it's funny with books, you never know when they're going to hit the zeitgeist. And the book that I wrote when I was 17, 18 has just been turned into a 20-hour miniseries in Australia. So for me, it was like watching a home movie. And they did an excellent job, because often producers, I mean, usually they couldn't produce a urine sample. If they did, it'd be so toxic, they'd be stamping due dates in a prison library like forevermore. But they were incredibly inclusive. They let me read every script, tweak the dialogue. So I've brought back into the vernacular some hideous Australian expressions like titting off. Titting off is when the man gets his hand under your bra, you know, which is like foreplay number two or something. And many other expressions which I probably can't say on air. Rooting and all sorts of things. So, yes, it's been a really hilarious experience seeing that book resonate with young people, because I thought it would have passed its amuse-by date. But, of course, all the things that obsessed me as a teenager, sex, drugs, rock and roll, love, lust, parental, trying to, you know, bridge the gap, the Grand Canyon gap between the generations, are still completely relevant today. And kids, I think it's worse in a way now because of kids. Kids have all that pressure of the porn industry. So I was really shocked recently when I interviewed some teenage boys who were horrified to discover that girls have pubic hair because they've grown up on porn. They've been watching porn since they're 11. So it's gone back to sort of the Victorian times when Ruskin allegedly, you know, pulled out of his marriage because he couldn't face his wife's feminine charm, shall we say. Yes. So, you know, it's a very odd time to be young today.
That book really launched your career, and you went off to Hollywood where you were writing sitcoms. Tell me about that.
Well, I'd written two books. I'd written Puberty Blues and Girls' Night Out, and one of the producers on this big long-running show in America contacted me to say, would I come over and work on the program, because they liked my voice. But of course, the thing about Hollywood, the thing they like about you is the very first thing they try and change. So as soon as I got there into the writing room, they kind of dipped me in disinfectant and tried to tone me down. But it was a fascinating experience and taught me a lot about writing. Because all of those shows like Seinfeld and, you know, Frasier and all the sitcoms we love, they're all written by about nine people. They lock you in this windowless padded room I used to call the gag gulag, where it's like being a stand-up comedian except sitting down. You're just pitching comedy all day. I was locked in the room with eight Jewish guys and one woman. You know, I got so Jewish when I was in there, the hair, the shoes, the jokes, the hands. I got so Jewish, I feel guilty that I'm not. But they taught me a lot about comic timing and about not being precious about your material and the fact there's always a better joke, always a better quip, always a better line. So it was really fascinating. And, of course, George Clooney was one of the young actors on the show.
You famously turned him down.
Accidentally. I mean, he just asked me out for coffee, being really nice. And we were allergic to the actors because they got paid so much more than us. And most of them were keeping fit by doing step aerobics off their own egos. They'd been in the show since they were about nine. So they had elephantiasis of the ego. So when this lovely man asked me out for coffee, I'm like, I'm a writer. I don't go out with actors. You know, you put other people's words in your mouth when you never know where they've been. I was so supercilious. It wasn't until years later when I was in London. I'd met Jeff, moved here, had two babies. I mean, I hadn't slept for years. I was covered in vomit, the usual maternal miasma going on in my head. And one of my writer friends was visiting me, and ER was on in the background. I was going, oh, look at that Dr. Ross. Isn't he gorgeous? I could swim through a pool of my own drill to get to that guy. And he said, but that's the guy we cast. That was Tootie's boyfriend. So that's the man who asked you out for coffee. And I'm like, ah! I lay in a fetal position and cried for like 2 months. But I'm friends with him now. We're friends because he married Amal, wonderful Amal, who's works with Jeff at Dowdy Street Chambers. So we've kindled a friendship now, and he's absolutely wonderful. He's just the most charming man, erudite, intellectual. I mean, he really is every girl's wet dream. But she's fabulous too, Amal, so I'm really, really happy for them. They're so in love.
Your writing career obviously went from strength to strength after that stint in Los Angeles. You've ended up here in London. Just take us on that journey.
I went back to Sydney because of the writer's strike. There was a very big writer's strike and we all laid down our pens. And so I went home to see my mum and my sisters. And while I was there, I went on to a TV show called Hypotheticals, which Jeff used to host. They used to use them at Harvard Law School, where they take a hypothetical situation and they play it out with a panel of prime ministers and pop stars and poets and head of the army. You know, then they come up with a scenario, and then you talk to each other about what you would do. It's a really fascinating intellectual exercise. And I actually sat in for Kylie Minogue, who couldn't go at the last minute. And Jeff always says that if only she had turned up that night, he'd now be Mr. Minogue. And I'm like, yeah, in your wet dreams, Robertson. But so we kind of met across a crowded studio. And it's very odd to have footage of your first meeting. You know, my eyelash batting average would rival Alan Border. Is he a good batsman? Shane Warne, you know, was batting away. And we sat up and talked all night and he asked me to get married 2 weeks later. So it was really like we just... It was like lightning striking. We felt really madly, crazily in love. So, yes, it's interesting how your life takes a different turn. And suddenly I found myself living in England. I'd always thought of England as the enemy camp, you know, being convict stock, First Fleet and Second Fleet. And we have inverted snobbery in Australia. So I always call myself the creme de la creme because, you know, if you can trace yourself back to the convict ancestors, that makes you sort of Antipodean royalty. So I am like, you know, yes, I should have a little tiara made out of corks or something. Yes.
Fitting in here is something that you've written about, of course. I mean, yes. A lot of your work is issue-driven, but let's talk about that and the whole cracking the establishment, if you like.
Well, I think it was Eleanor Roosevelt who said that great quote about no one can make you feel inferior unless you let them. So when I arrived here, I did meet so many people who had a condescension chromosome. I always say they've been at Oxford for so long, they've got ivy growing up the backs of their legs. And what they graduated in is advanced smuggery. They had this way, I used to call them the Navratilovas of the backhanded compliment, because they had this way of putting you down, but in a nice way. So they'd say things like, oh, you're Australian, so refreshing. You see, and I thought that meant they really liked me. You see, you know what that means. Yeah. I didn't know it meant off rack alpha, you loudmouth colonial nymphomaniac. And I'm like, how dare they call me a loudmouth, please, you know, have my standards. Oh, what was this other great line? They'd say things to me like, oh, aren't you brave to wear that in London? So you can't see, and you can't see yourself from the back. So what does it matter anyway? You know, all that kind of thing. And what did one other woman say to me? Oh, one very famous member of the literati, I won't say her name, but she once said to me, oh, it's so tedious being beautiful. Men underestimate my intelligence. And I just wish I could make myself less attractive. Then she looked me up and down and said, so tell me, Kathy, how do you do it? I mean, that's a classic. So I quickly realised that the only way to beat them was to laugh at them and write their dialogue down. So it was wonderful. I'd say, oh, thank you, that's a great line. I'd put it down and I used it all in a book called Fetal Attraction.
Well, and you write a lot about women, but particularly about women supporting each other, actually. You have a wonderful line about
women being each other's human wonder bras, uplifting, supportive, and making each other look bigger and better. And I totally believe that. And all of my books are very, very supportive of women. And I try and, I'm obviously a strong feminist, but I always try and sugarcoat the message in quips and one-liners and witty asides, so that if you can make someone laugh, you're much more likely to let what you're really saying sink into them. They won't be defensive. But I have three amazing sisters, wonderful mother, fantastic girlfriends on both sides of the planet. And I adore my women friends. And I do think that women should support each other in that way, because it is still a man's world.
I wanted to talk about opportunities that arise from having written amazing books, like, for instance, being writer in residence at the Savoy.
Yeah, well, that was incredible. I think it was 2003 or 2004, they rang me up and said, would I like to be writer in residence at the Savoy? And I'm like, I don't know. I've got to go to Waitrose. You know, I've got to get my toenails cut. I'm like, are you kidding me? Do you want my firstborn child or what? So they wanted to rekindle their literary links because a lot of famous writers had lived there. You know, Oscar Wilde, Noel Coward, Emil Zola, Somerset Maugham, Kathy Lett, natural segue, I thought. So it was amazing. I got this beautiful suite on the river. I used to ring my girlfriends and say, ask me the time, ask me the time. They go, why? And I said, just ask me. They go, gee, Kath, what's the time? And I'd say, I don't know. Just let me look out the window at Big Ben. And I didn't, but mind you, I didn't do any writing. I just had a lot of cocktail parties. I've got my own drink on the menu called Kathy Cassis. We put a lot of research into that. I remember Julian Barnes came there for a drink with me once. We were drinking Kathy Cassis's. I said, well, it's wonderful to have a cocktail on the menu, but I'm just worried about how many men can go around town now saying that they've had me. And he said, don't worry, Kathy, as long as they say you went down rather well. And I thought, for Julian, you know, who's a little bit pinstriped, underpanted, I adore him, but you know what I mean. That was quite risque. I had to have literary dinners. I think I had about four literary dinners. John Mortimer, was my best friend. He used to call himself my toy boy, but then he would say it would take him 2 weeks to get a soft on. Salman Rushdie, we wore our bulletproof bras that night. Richard E. Grant and Stephen Fry, he's one of my best friends too. So that sounds like I'm going for gold in the name-dropping Olympics. I'm not. It's just that he was a neighbour and we became really good friends like 20 years ago or something. So it was just wonderful. Yeah, it was better than winning the Booker Prize.
Tell me about charity work, because that's another spin-off, of course, from being very well known in literary circles.
Right. Well, of course, I think anyone who has been fortunate enough to do well in life should give back as much as they possibly can. And Plan International I work for a lot, as well as an ambassador, because I've been out in the field and see what they do. They're very practical. I mean, women are still runners up in the human race. We know that. And one of the ways to beat the cycle of poverty is to beat the menstrual cycle. If you can stop girls getting pregnant at 11 when their lives are then ruined, you know, they can have a chance at education and at pulling themselves up out of poverty. So what I like about Plan, it's about education, contraception and nutrition. And it's very, very hands-on. So I do support them. I also support lots of women's charities. But also I do a lot of work for autism now because I finally came out about the fact that I have an autistic son, which I'd kept secret for a long, long time. So I work for the National Autistic Society and I also work for Ambitious About Autism and all sorts of other autism charities.
You wrote a wonderful book about it.
Oh, thank you. The Boy Who Fell to Earth. Yes, I definitely dipped my pen in my artery for that one because, you know, gosh, when you have an autistic child, there's no owner's manual. I sometimes don't think I gave birth to my son, but I found him under a spaceship and I'm raising him as my own. He's taught me a lot. He's taught me there's no such thing as normal and abnormal. There's ordinary and extraordinary. And people on the spectrum are quite exceptional. And we now know with diagnostic hindsight that Einstein and Mozart and Orwell and Van Gogh and all these amazing scientists and mathematicians and creative people were on the autistic spectrum. But only 15% of people with autism are in the workforce, which is much lower than any other disability. So too often they end up living in a bedsit on benefits. But with the right help, you know, they could give back to society in the most fascinating way. So he's really taught me that. And he's also taught me that it's always better to talk about things. You know, I didn't want to talk about him having autism because I didn't want to invade his privacy. But every day I get letters from other mothers and people thanking me for putting into words what their lives are like. So it's always better to shine a light into a dark corner. And when I wrote that book, I tried to make it, you know, funny too, because if you are raising a child with special needs, you quickly develop a very black sense of humour. So black, you need those night vision goggles, you know. And a lot of it is funny too, because people on the autistic spectrum have no filter. You know, they say whatever they're thinking, which means that when I take him out socially, I sort of sweat more than Paris Hilton doing a Sudoku because I never know what he's going to say. Two little examples. I took him to Downing Street to a charity thing once when he was about 11 or 12. I said, oh, Jules, this is the Prime Minister, Tony Blair. I remember Jules looking at Tony Blair and saying, oh, yes, you're the one my mother calls Tony blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, you know, I couldn't think what to say or to do. It was so embarrassing. And then I took him to some other function. Ann Widdecombe was there. And I said, oh, Jules, this is Ann Widdecombe. You know, and he said, oh, yes, you're the one my mother says is two-faced. But if so, why are you wearing that one when it's all wrinkly and crinkly and old? So it's like they've taken a truth serum. And I think, you know, in this day and age when truth is such a rare commodity, you know, we're never told the truth by advertisers or politicians or anybody. I'm going to set him up in a truth booth where people can pay to come in and he can actually tell them call it like it is.
You talk about autobiography and how that book really was very much based on your own life, but many, many of your books seem to come from a place within.
Well, it's writing novels is cheaper than therapy. I always write the book I wish I'd had when I was going through something, whether it's, you know, being a single girl in Sydney trying to find a man who's not married or gay or married and gay or doesn't think monogamy is something you make dining room tables out of, you know, whether it's getting married, whether it's being pregnant or having children or raising teenage girls or whatever. I always try to articulate what I've learned from that experience, but in a funny, comedic, accessible way to make other women's lives easier. And also because, as you know, as I said, it's much, much better than lying on some shrink's couch. I think that's a terrible waste of couches. I can think of much better things to do on it. So, yeah. And so I wait to see what's boiling up inside me, what's driving me crazy, you know, whether it's the facial prejudice that women suffer, or just how after 50 you get wrapped in the invisible man's bandages and sidelined, or whether it's trying to make friends with a teenage daughter, which is a bit like living with the Taliban, not allowed to laugh, sing, dance, or wear short skirts. Although I have got one really good survival tip for any mother out there if she's having a bad time raising her teenage daughter. Next time she hits you and kicks you and says, "I wish you'd just die," take a big drag on a cigarette and a big gulp of wine and say, "I'm doing my best, darling." That's my top tip.
Now, in terms of autobiography, of course, as we know, you're married to a top human rights lawyer, and so the legal profession is something that's in your mind a lot of the time. And we also know that you're very, very strong on women's rights. So your latest book, Courting Trouble, addresses all of that.
Yeah. Well, when I came to write this 13th novel, I thought, oh, actually, I've cannibalised my entire life. I haven't got anything left. So I thought I'd cannibalise my husband's life because I have been hanging around lawyers for so long. And Helena Kennedy is one of my very good friends. So the book's dedicated to her, because she's promised to get me off when I kill my first book critic. Very, very useful having someone like that in your life. So I thought, what are the two things I like to do the most? I love to write women's dialogue. I love to write banter between women because I think women are so funny when we're together and so candid. And I also like books that have a feminist cause. So I thought, well, I'll invent a law firm. I've made up the world's first mother-daughter, barrister-solicitor, two-person boutique feminist law firm where they only take on women's cases and women's causes. And the first case they take on was based on a true story in Melbourne where a girl was raped and her grandmother went around with the hunting gun and shot both men in the testicles. And, of course, you know, all the shock jocks on radio were like, you cannot take your law into your own hands. But women kept ringing in saying, well, she's not going to get a fair trial. They'll probably get off. Why can't we take the law into our own hands? And I thought it's an interesting conundrum for a lawyer who believes in the law. If something happened to her own daughter, you know, the gulf between beliefs and behaviour, would she then ever think, yes, she would take the law into her own hands? So it was a good moral dilemma to play with. And it's very topical because it's about Twitter trolls. It's about the brutal cross-examination of girls in rape trials where they're made to feel that they're the perpetrator instead of the victim. You know, I hate it when I hear someone say, oh, she asked for it. Imagine that in a murder trial saying, oh, she asked for it. It was consensual death. You know, it's ludicrous. So the book is sadly very topical because it's also about sexual grooming and gang violence and that kind of thing. But I tried to balance that out with lots of also good meaty, it's a good sort of love story and great comedy between the mother and daughter, kind of odd couple comedy, which is always funny. So I think if you get, it's like making a cake, writing a good book, you've got to get the recipe right.
It is. I mean, it is enormously topical. There's so much in there.
Oh, frighteningly so, yeah.
You talk about how you came to write the book and your own experience on jury service.
I was on jury service in the late 90s, I think it was. I was writing a book called Mad Cows that had courtroom scenes in it. So, and jury service came up. So I thought, oh, that's perfect timing. And it was a sexual assault case. And we were misdirected as a jury by the judge because there was no forensic evidence. The judge said, well, you can't. He directed us to say that it wouldn't be a safe conviction. And so I was in the jury room. You're not supposed to talk about what goes in the jury room, but it was like one angry woman and 11 pissed off people who wanted lunch. More deliberation went into the lunch order than it did into her case. And I totally believed her. She was so plausible. But then the judge had misdirected the jury, so he was acquitted. When he was acquitted, we then found out he had a string of similar offences against women. And when I got home and told my husband what had happened, he said, but the judge has misdirected you because her testimony is evidence. And then some years later, I was very upset about what had happened to her, and I wrote to her, actually, which you're not supposed to do. I contacted the police, and I wrote to her and said, I totally believed you, and the judge was wrong. And she wrote back and said, thank me so much for writing to her, because she was devastated when he got off, and she was made to feel as though she was the culprit. And she said it meant so much to her to know that just one person had totally believed her. Okay, a few years later, first of all, the judge was struck off for fraud. We discovered that he was an absolute, you know, scumbag. And then I was watching television one day and this man's face popped up, Kirk Reed. I recognised him from this trial. And he went on to rape 100 women. Mm. He's the most notorious rapist in British history. And I thought we could have stopped him that day, or at least we could have, you know, we could have stopped him in his tracks, really. So that will haunt me forever that that happened. And so I did have a lot of anger always about that court case. And I wanted to write something about what women go through when they're brave enough to bring a rape case to trial. And I do think they need to re-educate barristers and judges on how to cross-examine women who are already feeling so vulnerable and exposed. And it should not be the ordeal that it is.
And that's all in Court in Trouble, which is out now.
Kathy, it's going to be a TV series. I've sold the TV rights, so I'm about to drive around town with a casting couch strapped to my roof racks, casting a few gorgeous young love gods. So, yeah, I'm really looking forward to that.
And apart from that TV series, what else? What's next for Kathy Lett?
Well, I've got another book in production called To Love, On and Betray, which is set in Sydney on the beaches there. It's about an English woman, fish out of water comedy. That's going into production with Euston Films. And I'm turning The Boy Who Fell to Earth into a play. And I'm writing a series for Red Production, who did Happy Valley. I'm doing something for them. And I'm going to be a cartoon. I've always wanted to be on a stamp, right? Because I thought, oh, being licked all day, job satisfaction. But next best thing, I'm going to be a post-it note and I'm going to be on stationery. They've made 70 cartoons of me with all my little quips, the stationery company. And so I thought, well, broadsheets don't review women's fiction. It's pretty much, you know, all about the boys. It's a boys' club. So I thought, if they're not going to review me and take me seriously, I might as well go to the other extreme and become a cartoon and a caricature. It's going to be called Quiplash, because I do think women are more verbally dexterous than men. We're not as physically strong as men, but we have this other skill that we can shoot from the lip and give a good tongue lashing. So I always say to girls, the one thing you need to develop is a black belt in Tung Fu. You can decimate a guy with a good one-liner. So that's what I'm going to equip them with.
Kathy Lett, thanks so much for being my guest on Meet the Writers. Courting Trouble is published by Penguin. It's out now. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to production team of Toby Hammond and Mike Hewan. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.